will bring you the March 28, 2014 rain report in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the studios of the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Ron Schmalz, N9QOB, with this rain report. If you've been a long-time listener to these rain reports, you will not ever recall hearing the term remote sensing. So just what is it? At the 2013 Dayton Hamvention, Mark Spencer, WA8SME, ARRL Education and Technology Program Director, spoke about the importance and evolution of remote sensing.
I was thinking about this the other day, and I believe that through most of my professional career, I have been doing remote sensing. Back when I was flying B-52s, I guess that's the ultimate remote sensing. We were planning to drop a nuclear bomb on somebody. In reconnaissance and intelligence gathering, we did a lot of remote sensing. And now in the educational community, I'm working a lot with CubeSats and sensing buoys and that kind of thing. Students are doing environmental studies. That's all remote sensing. So I've been doing this for quite a while by default. And from the educational perspective, we have areas that we want to sense or explore. There's local areas, there's regional areas, and there's global and beyond. Why do we do remote sensing? What are we doing this for? Well, for learning, a lot for self-actualization. I think the ham radio operators are now getting more and more involved in remote sensing for self-actualization, and these self-actualization needs are beyond the safety and survival concerns. So, for instance, if you want to know if something is hot, before remote sensing, what did you do? You stuck your finger in it. When you touch it with your finger, it's hot and dangerous, or it's cold, or it's okay. Then some technology like a thermometer came on board, and now we could sense it, determine whether it's hot or cold, but also how hot and how cold. So the technology allowed us to quantify that. And also, by collecting data, we could use that information for advanced warning. So as we monitor the temperature, and as the temperature number increases, we know that at some point there's going to be a trigger. We're going to have to take some action. So, for instance, your thermistor on your furnace, there's going to be some trigger. It's either too cold, kick on the furnace, too hot, kick off the furnace, or whatever. So as we change in our perspective of remote sensing, we're going from basically satisfying survival needs to the other end of the spectrum of self-actualization needs. I'm working on what I'm calling the Wobbler Simulator, which is going to fly in FOX 1A, and it's going to measure the rotation rate of the satellite. Now, for survival means, I need to explain to my wife why I'm doing this. But in reality, my life is not really going to depend on the wobbling of a satellite. I'm truly doing it for personal self-actualization needs. Because it's there, I think I can do it, and it's delaying the symptoms of Alzheimer's for as long as I can. That's the educational spectrum for self-actualization to safety needs. And then we have the thermistor in his home on your furnace. You have your local weather station in your backyard. So that's your local area. Then your local weather station that's connected to the APRS system, disseminating your temperature throughout the APRS network. That's regional. And then we go up to global and beyond, and that's putting the sensors in space. So remote sensing really covers a broad area. Now, here's just a sample of the types of remote sensors that are out there. You have thermistors, you have barometric pressure, humidity, acceleration, proximity. In other words, you get close to it, something happens. Forces and motions, we have directions, locations. GPS is nothing more than a sensor. Light intensity and color, magnetic fields and radiation in space, sound intensity and frequency, imagery, gas type and concentration, and of course the simple on-off. And this is just a partial list, and this list is growing exponentially. Every time I go to DigiKey, there's another sensor that's $1 or $2 that, by the way, has an instruction manual that's 400 pages long. But man, I want to try and use that. It's a never-ending quest.
You are listening to The Rain Report from www.therainreport.com.
So how do all those sensors work? Well, there's some basic techniques that they use. There's a change in resistance. So in the case of the thermistor is a special kind of resistive material that as the temperature changes, the resistance changes. There are sensors where the capacitance changes. Usually humidity sensors are capacitive-based. There are changes in frequency. I mentioned the wobbler experiment. There's actually a microscopic arm in there that's oscillating, and the oscillation depends on the direction of rotation and the speed of rotation on how that thing oscillates. There's a change in duty cycle. There's a change in period. The change in duty cycle and a change in period are how seismometers work. There's things that change in length. There are some sensors that will grow when they get heated. For instance, the old type thermostats in your house, if you took them apart, you would have seen a coil of flat metal material that as that material heated up, the coil would expand and the lever would go up and it'd flip a micro switch and you'd turn on your furnace. Changes in volume, changes in sound and acoustic. So those are just a sampling of how some of these things work. Then on the other side, how do you talk to these things? Well, there are a couple of protocols that have surfaced that are commonly used today. I can't remember exactly what those acronyms are. I'd have to look them up. But there's I2C, there's SPI, and USART is basically serial communications. And each one of those have their place in different circuits in different ways. Some of them are more easy to implement than others, but these are just a few of the strategies to extract the information out of the sensors and put it into a format that could be sent somewhere else. And then in imagery, we have automatic picture taking, which takes a snapshot. There's slow scan TV, there's amateur TV, there's digital, and there's going to be more and more imagery type protocols in the future. I mentioned a little bit about price. I assume there are a lot of Adreno people in the audience, and maybe not. But anyway, if you take a look at a sensor, if the sensor is simple to operate and very basic and does not do any processing on the sensor, it's just sensing and spitting out a voltage or a current or something like that, the cost will be low, and so you have the raw data. But on the other side of this coin, it's very difficult to interface to that sensor. As you increase the amount of onboard processing that the sensor does, it makes it a little easier to interface, but the costs start going up. So there's a trade-off. How much is your time worth? If you have a lot of time to kill and you want to get into the very basics of the sensor, you buy the raw sensor, you do the programming and so forth to extract the data, and you pay a couple of dollars for the sensor. On the other end of the spectrum, you can have a sensor that does it all for you, and it spits out the temperature and ozone concentration in a number that you can just put right into a computer, but the costs go up substantially. Just a matter of choice.
Mark Spencer, WA8SME, ARRL Education and Technology Program Director, speaking about remote sensing during his 2013 Dayton Hamvention Forum talk. The Rain Report is copyright 1990-2014 Rain, all rights reserved. Now for Rain's founder and producer, Hap Holly, KC9RP, I'm Ron Schmalz, N9QOB, bidding you very 73 from the Radio Amateur Information Network, www.therainreport.com.